Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
This is such an exciting time. We're going to do chapter 20 today. And you think, wow, it's only 15 verses. This isn't going to take any time at all. But it's actually, there's a lot of details to this, especially I believe verse 4 is just is intensely long. If I remember right, as I was going through my notes here and everything. And it makes a lot of sense because what this chapter is has a lot of discussion. I was going to say controversy, but there is. Well, maybe we'll say debate about what is really going on here in last chapter as well. And there's a lot of revelation, but it seems like as we get into this particular section here, a lot of debate because we're starting to talk about the millennium and, you know, amillennial, premillennial, postmillennial, all that sort of stuff that doesn't really matter at the end of the day because we have no control over it. But at the same time is, I guess, interesting to kind of toss about. And so I'm going to give you probably what would be considered a light premillennial view today on this based on that. And I don't necessarily follow that one. I don't follow either, any of them. But it's one of those things that will be something that will discuss to. If I was told to, if someone would say to me, hey, you must, I'd say, first of all, I don't. But then if I must, I will say maybe premillennial. See, that's about how strong I feel about this one. So anyways, we'll get rolling here. A lot of attention is given to the first 10 verses of chapter 20, as I've said. Chapter 20 itself is pretty good. That's the first two-thirds of the chapter. Very much debate. Some think it is actually even the main point of the entire book of Revelation, not just the chapter, but of the entire Revelation. There's a tendency for many to point to a particular view, like I said, related to the millennium, and it's based on exactly this section, because this, I think, the only time we'll really see anything about 1,000 years. And we'll discuss what 1,000 years means, because it doesn't literally mean a literal 1,000 years. Well, some people would say it does, but some people want it. And I'm probably with those people who want it because there's based on the symbolism. But at the same time, you can look at 1,000 years as a literal 1,000 years, but at the same time, look at 1,000 years as symbolic of a significant period of time or a significant age of time or a dispensation. No, that's not the right word I want to use, but a time period. Let's just go there. We can all agree it is a very important passage, but it should not be elevated above the themes we have been studying up to this point related to the return of Christ, the final judgment, and the removal of evil from the earth, and ultimately the beauty and splendor of the final state. You know, apocalyptic literature was very popular during this time, especially Jewish apocalyptic literature had been around probably by this time, four to 500 years, maybe not that long, but a significant amount of time. So people who are listening to this would know a lot of the symbolism. I've talked about this briefly before, but sometimes we forget. And we also have to remember that apocalypse just means to reveal, to open up, to show, to expose. It doesn't mean, actually apocalypse is not a bad word. It just means to reveal something. So we have taken it and turned it into something that's maybe a little bit more negative. But at the end of the day, it is not a negative word. So looking at the first 10 verses, we should conclude that it is mainly speaking of the resurrected martyrs alone. And with that, there is no indication that this reign with Christ takes place on earth or that it already really even follows the second advent of Christ. We'll focus on the millennium portrayed as an earthly reign following the second coming of Christ. However, the text does not rule out alternate viewpoints. So, like I said, there's much debate about this. I encourage you to hold loosely as we go forward to your views of pre, post, and amillennial, and instead focus on the promises of what Revelation is trying to communicate, the promises of hope and the love of God for those who believe in him and remain faithful, even faithful to the end of time. We'll look at the first three verses here. I'm trying not to look at chapter 21, but of chapter 20, And we'll read those and then kind of run through that. And like I said, verse 4, we're going to give that its own kind of whole thing here after we do the first three verses and then move on from there. So verses 1 through 3 of chapter 20, then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding the key of the abyss. You have to look at the word of then, as in this is a continuation of the previous vision. And a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan. Look at all the names. And bound him for 1,000 years, and he threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Wow. Look at that. We get into this fast. A lot going on already. It is believed that we are reintroduced or re-meet the angel from chapter 9 here, who held the key to the door of the abyss. And let the, if you can remember back from chapter 9, he was the one, or he or it, not sure if angels are male or female in the way we know them, but anyways, the angel let the demonic locusts out. So if you go back to chapter 9, you'd see this. In this period, it was believed that there was a place like the abyss where disobedient spirits were confined, waiting to be judged. You can see that probably referenced in Jude 6. The great chain that he carries is most likely something we would refer to as handcuffs or fetters, something that you would cuff the arms or hands or wrists and ankles with to keep you from getting away, from running away. We remember, of course, Paul and Barnabas were in those very sort of things. We're not given any evidence when this is to take place, but based on the "and I saw" does imply a sequence of events that carries from the appearance of the rider on the white horse. This then points forward to chapter 21, where we see the establishment of the new heaven and the new earth, a place that Satan cannot occupy. Verses 2 and 3, the angel seemingly takes into custody or overcomes the dragon and then binds him, the dragon being Satan, the devil, however you want to call him. We know that at the end of 1,000 years, the dragon will be let loose for a short period of time, and we will learn more about that later on in verses 7 through 10, where Satan is freed and then doomed. We can note here that all four titles that have described Satan are brought out here. As I said, he is the dragon who is defeated in combat by the angel Michael. If you go back to chapter 12, verses 7 through 8, he is the serpent who tried to get rid of the messianic community with the flood, back in chapter 12. Verse 15, and the devil who knows his time is short in chapter 12. Verse 12, we have two options regarding the timing of the binding. Is it taken as descriptive of the present age or of a period that will follow the second advent or the second coming? I don't know. There's two. I'll give you the two options. You guys can decide what you think you believe on that, because I'm not here to indoctrinate you, just to provide some information. The influence of the devil, so this is option one. The influence of the devil is limited, keeping him unable to prevent the ongoing expansion of the church. So the idea of what the devil was hoping to do was to destroy the church and keep it from expanding and bringing light to the darkness. That was its role. So this would be based on the first coming of Christ. So the evidence here could be from, say, if you went to Matthew 12:29 or Luke 19:17-18 or John 12:31. Option two, however, is a little bit different. It is the render Satan not as merely restricted but completely inactive during the 1,000-year millennial period following the second coming of Christ. This could be back from scripture where Satan is very active in our present age. So if you looked at Luke 22:3, Acts 5:3, and 2 Corinthians 4:3-4. 1 Peter 5:8 is a very strong example of this idea. Your enemy and devil prowls around like a roaming lion looking for someone to devour. So there are your two possible options that we could look at here. As with many texts in the Bible, both sides can argue the same verses and get different outcomes, much like we have with the idea of egalitarian versus a complementarian view of women's role in the church. So that's just another example of it. And that's what people have been doing with Revelation for years. There's other examples in the Bible where people look the exact same text but interpret it differently based on their own worldview. And that's okay, because it's still moving us along of that God is a God of love and a God that redeems and a God of salvation and a God of hope, and that we can live in hope and we can live in that way of love and knowing that God is merciful and everything. None of that is taken away from that, but We like to, because we're humans, we like to debate things, we like to be certain about things, but that's not really why the Bible was written, to be certain. What we need to focus on here is the text of Revelation itself. What we get from the text is that during a period designated as 1,000 years, Satan is bound and cast into an abyss, which is locked and then sealed. The purpose at this point does not seem to be punishment, but confinement, to keep him from deceiving people, to keep him from stopping the church from advancing. So that was his goal, like I said, to bring darkness to the world while the church is bringing lightness to the darkness. He's trying to stop the light. Based on the angel bounds him up, we can understand the implication of complete cessation of his influence on the earth. We know the abyss, based on earlier chapters, is sealed. We know about the abyss from the earlier chapters, and we know here that it is sealed, and Satan's imprisonment is to last 1,000 years. The sealing ensures that Satan does not escape, so you could reference Daniel 6:17 and Matthew 27:66 to get more context on this. Like I said, some people will take this as a literal 1,000 years, while others, we could say the majority of them would look at this as a lengthy period of undetermined duration. I like that, because I don't feel like John really knew it was 1,000 years, but he's using it as a way to explain a long period of time. We could use 2 Peter 3:8 to help strengthen this view, where we see the equation of 1 day and 1,000 years. Nothing within this context support either position, so don't worry about falling on your sword for either options. Now, then you have some commentators who look at 1,000 years not as a period of time, but as a way of saying that Satan will be contained. There's no chronological significance to 1,000 years, but instead it is to symbolize what some people would say the blessedness of those who are faithful and the helplessness of Satan, so to show that sort of thing. Others would say you must take the 1,000 years literally. This is what makes apocalyptic literature so much fun. So take what you want, and take the point of view you want to take. Don't be mean about it, but you know it is what it is. But let's just move on and check out something that doesn't seem quite right. As you recall from chapter 19, the kings of the earth were killed with the sword of the Messiah. However, here in chapter 20, the nations still seem to still be in existence. Those very kings still seem to be around. This, in apocalyptic literature, is really not a problem to have overlapping scenes and repetition. This is just the style of apocalyptic literature. And we have to always remember that chronological precision is not necessary when it comes to this. If you must have some chronological order, as I know some of you would, to this, we would see that the nations in verse 3 as the remnants of the nations who oppose the Messiah, rather than the select nations here, and those who did not enter the battle, possibly those on the fringe who did share in the campaign of the Antichrist. Either way, we can see that they are no longer under the influence of Satan and are no longer deceived in giving all of their focus and worship to the emperor. We can look ahead to the close of the 1,000 years period, if you want to do that, and see that Satan is freed for a short time. We could be wasting our time speculating why this happened. What we do know is that Satan again gains power, and it seems he is still intent on destroying believers, and there are still plenty of folks around who are wicked and want to join Satan and rebel against God, which I just find to be fascinating after knowing what they know, or you think they would know, of Satan and the evil and the deception up to this point, and all the plagues and junk that they've had to face, the bulls and the seals and the related hoo-ha. Anyways, as we go forward here, let's look at the next set of verses 4 through 6. We have the millennial reign. Then I saw thrones, verse 4, then I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was given to them, and I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God. And those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and not received the mark on their foreheads and on their hand, and they became to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until 1,000 years were completed. This is the first resurrection. That causes some issues. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. So we're going to look at verses 4 through 6. This is a bear of amount of commentary that we're going to have to provide here to kind of help provide some, at least a little bit of understanding. And again, this is one perception from me based on the amount of research I've done on this. So you can take this however you'd like to take it. Just like the millennial thing, like I said, I don't hold tightly to one view or another. They're all intriguing at some level. But anyways, let's move forward here. So we're now about to enter into what John is depicting as a courtroom. It looks like a courtroom is being described here. We have judges sitting on thrones in front of them, and in front of these thrones stand those who are referred to as the faithful. So these are the ones who remain loyal to God and did not worship the beast. They were brought to reign with Christ for 1,000 years. This is known as the first resurrection. Remember here, and what we'll notice is that there's no, it doesn't seem like there's a bodily resurrection. It seems maybe this is more of a spiritual type resurrection. Again, take it as you will, but that's my observation. Death has no power over those who are faithful, and they will serve as priests to God during this, what is referred to as the millennium. It seems, however, that after 1,000 years, the dead will come to life. Recall in the previous section of Scripture that Satan was bound, so now the church can reign. Wow, man, the yawns. Can reign victorious. We're not sure, and there's a lot of debate about what this reign involves and when it takes place, because there's not a whole lot of detail given here related to that. We're going to work through what could be considered a premillennial viewpoint as we go through this, as we go especially through verse 4, but we'll be quite hesitant when it comes to chronology. Recall that as we move into an eschatological time and into eternity, that we may measure time will be inadequate in explaining the full eschatological truth. Keep that in mind. Verse 4. So, that was just a summary of verses 4 through 6. Verse 4 here. We witness here that we have a view of the thrones and those who are faithful. We're not sure who the folks on the throne are, but they have been given the ability to judge. It is possible to look at this as a less about judging and more about ruling, as and they have been given the right to rule with Christ for 1,000 years and not judge for 1,000 years. The use of the 1,000, as we know, is a multiple of 10, suggesting total and complete victory. Again, we talked about 1,000 a little bit earlier, and we're going to talk about a little bit more here, which is, so it could be. It could be, we do know that 1,000 is multiple of 10. That's a fact. But we do can also understand, based on their context at the time and their understanding of the number 1,000, that is a complete, means a total and complete victory. So that could be it. Another reason we're not taking this literal, because we miss out on the message if we do. If we think it's ought to be 1,000 years, there's no other way it's not 1,000 years. If it's not 1,000 years, then the Bible's right. Well, we're wrong at that point, because, well, I think you're wrong, or you may be wrong. You may not be thinking that. But anyways, it's one of those things that it is symbolism tied to this that we have to be aware of as we go forward. The 1,000 is important, as it is mentioned 6 times in this scene. So we've noticed it already, and we're going to notice a little bit more. And this points to the deep persistence of evil. The evil was deeply ingrained in society and is hard to eradicate. And so there's this usage of repetition here to help provide some explanation around that. The judgment here seems to be connected, or the ruling, either one, with a vindication of the martyrs and their right to assume the empire of the defeated powers of the wickedness. We could take Daniel's vision of the four beasts, their judgment, and the passing of the kingdom of the saints as the background for what John is trying to communicate. Remember, a lot of what what John communicates throughout this has a lot of tie into Enoch, Ezra, and then something probably you're more familiar with the book of Daniel, Ezekiel, Isaiah, Hosea. He uses a lot of Old Testament texts and a lot of Jewish texts to make his point. Then again, he was a Jew just like Jesus was, and so that's why you always see those sort of references to Jewish scripture, because that's what they knew. We cannot say that the martyrs are those who are sitting under, who are the ones who are sitting on the throne, because they don't show up until later in the verse. Some would say this text seems a bit odd, because John died after completing chapter 20, verse 3. That's kind of a, kind of throw that in the middle of it, huh? You throw that kind of shocker in, it kind of slows the old sprockets down a little bit when you throw that stick in the wheel when that happens, right? John dies after chapter 20, verse 3. Some people would say so. And based on that, some people would say the faithful disciple edited the rest based on the documents from John, or possibly had no documents and were from memory. It's just one more wrinkle in the whole development of Revelation. So let's not get too self-righteous about the book of Revelation. We could possibly say that the thrones included the apostles, as determined by Matthew 19:28, where they are promised they will sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. They could be saints from 1 Corinthians 6:2-3, where they are reminded they will judge both the world and angels. Since the text does not tell us who the individuals are, it is wise not to speculate too much. If we reflect on Daniel chapter 7, verse 26, we can see that it is a heavenly court that will assist in judgment. So as we move away here from the thrones, we see that the souls who had been martyred for their faithfulness, these are believed to be the souls under the altar from chapter 6, verse 9. They are referred to as souls because they are still awaiting the resurrection. Just because it says they were beheaded does not mean that it actually was how they died. It is instead represents all who were faithful and gave their lives. So all of those who were martyrs. Not all of them were beheaded. Some of them we know were, but not all of them were. So let's not look at that too hard. We have some questions in the latter part of this verse, as if there are two believing groups being represented, those who had been beheaded and those who had not worshipped the beast. It is to be believed it is hard to explain what is being said in 13:15, because the beast put to death all who refused to worship the image of the beast. So to help with this confusion, it is best to look at this as two groups being one. So those who in chapter 13 refused to worship the beast or received this mark are consequently paid for their loyalty by death. Chapter 13, verse 15. These martyrs are said to come to life and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. How this is interpreted will determine the millennial viewpoint of an individual. The big question lies around they came to life again, or they lived, depending on your translation, depend on what you see. Besides, here in verse 5, we only see this tense, which is because you guys want to know an aorist active indicative is only found again in chapter 2, verse 8, of Christ who died and came to life again. The beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived is 13:14. So there's a lot of this kind of tied in here of how they came to life again, they lived. I mean, there's just how that plays out is very, very interesting. It's hard to argue that if the author had wished to speak of an actual physical resurrection, he'd have used some other verb, since there's no Greek verb that exclusively means to raise from the dead. So, you know, it just there's so much here that we sometimes overlook or don't know because we haven't really been paying attention to what was said when it was in the Greek or in the Hebrew or how that was written. So what we see is that the verb used in verse 4 should be taken the same as in verse 5, where in verse 5 seems to refer to a bodily resurrection at the close of the millennial period. So if they came to life in this verse, meaning a spiritual resurrection to new life in Christ, we need to figure out a persuasive reason to interpret the same very differently, the same verb differently within such a precise unit of text. So this is crazy. So we can quote the theologian. His last name is Alford. If what he said is, if in a passage where two resurrections are mentioned, the first resurrection may be understood to mean spiritual rising with Christ, while the second means literal rising from the grave, then there is an end of all significance in language, and Scripture is wiped out as a definite testimony to anything. Obviously, this is all now crystal clear. As we move on, we can take a look at the reign of the martyrs for 1,000 years, which gives rise to the term, of course, millennium. Only in chapter 20, verses 1 through 10, do we find any teaching really about a millennium. This idea seems to come from the late eschatological viewpoint of apocalyptic Judaism. Just a second. In earlier times, our Jewish friends would picture a messianic kingdom that would last on the present earth forever. So that's Isaiah 11:10-16. Then came dualism around 100 BC, where there was an increasing pessimism about this earth and this appropriate place for such a glorious period. So people were, let's get the heck out of this place because it's going straight. Well, you know, and let's leave. And that mentality continues to this day, which is an incorrect mentality. This seemed to change based on the desire to mediate between the earlier eschatological hope of an earthly kingdom in Palestine ruled by Yahweh and later a conception of a transcendental and universal kingdom for risen saints in renewed heaven and earth, which is where I like to be, the renewed heaven and earth, which is not, I would like to be there physically or however that works, but I would like to be there as in also that's what I believe. It is believed that Israel early on had contemplated a new historical and national era, so that was why they were hoping for all this to play out the way it would. But eventually they developed a more transcendental viewpoint or hope, which brought in the idea of a new heaven and a new earth. The theologian Crodel would say that the millennium is not a preliminary kingdom to be followed by an eternal kingdom, but is the beginning of the consummated kingdom of God and his Messiah. And the Messiah. The millennium reign, according to Jewish believers, could between, so this is how this works. So millennium, which we think means 1,000, could be a period of time of 40 to 7,000 years. That's why we don't take 1,000 years literally, because Jews looked at it completely different than what we like to look at it as. And I think they understood what John was writing much more better than we do as we're trying to figure it out over 2,000 years later. For example, in 2 Ezra 7:28, it is definitely set at 400 years. Some people argued from the week of creation and the 1,000 years equals one day idea that we see in Psalm 90, verse 4, that after 6,000 years of world history, there would be a 1,000-year cosmic Sabbath corresponding with the seventh day of creation in which God rested from his work. Based on the Jewish usage of 1,000 years, and its equation of days, it should not be surprised that John would sketch out the reign of the martyrs to be 1,000 years. John is not alone, as many of the earliest church fathers were referred to as millenarians. And what that, so you had, for example, Justin Martyr, believed that Christians who were properly instructed were assured of a resurrection of the dead to be followed by 1,000 years in Jerusalem. Irenaeus, in the same century, believed in an earthly millennium, during which the saints and the martyrs would be rewarded. We then had Archelaus, or another, I guess just another name for millenarians, who had all kinds of fun with this and read into the 1,000-year period in all manner of materialistic and sensuous extremes. For example, the earth's fertility would be such that each grape would yield 25 measures of wine and every grain of wheat 10,000 pounds of flour. There are others regarding sensual pleasure and luxurious living, but the materialistic Kielism was put to bed in the 3rd century by folks such as Origen, so that's not what the millennium will be like, not an orgy of sensual pleasure. Augustine in the 5th century, who made the first serious effort to interpret Revelation 20, is a non-millenarian, in a non-millenarian way, not saying that he was one, but it seems like that's what he would be if that's how he interpreted it. But either way, I'm not a guy to do labels. It was his belief that the 1,000 years would be an interval between the first advent and the final conflict. So the first advent, well, 2,000 years ago, so he was probably off a little bit. He believed that the binding of Satan during this period was accomplished by Christ when he was here on earth. Okay. And he believed the first resurrection to be a spiritual birth of believers. With that, some millenarians would ask, what is the purpose of the 1,000-year reign? Some would say it is a vindication within history of the cause of Christ. With the establishment of the kingdom of God upon earth, there is a tangible and convincing proof of the victory and righteousness over evil. We can take also from this text that the millennial reign with Christ as a special reward for martyrs who gave their lives rather than submit to the demands of emperor worship. So the 1,000-year reign is a special time for those from chapter 6. So from this, so many things we're being able to take this from, we can take that the millennium is not what the prophets taught in the Old Testament, but a special reward for those who have paid with their lives the price of faithful opposition to the adulterous claims of the Antichrist. So we are left with many more questions, but we'll answer one more. Are we to think of this millennial reign as an actual period of political and social history that follows the return of Christ? One argument is that when we distinguish the essential truth of prophecy from the form in which it was communicated, we'll cease to find in Revelation 20 the prediction of an eschatological era. The essential truth I think we can take from this passage is that the martyr's steadfastness will give them the highest life in union with God and Christ. This seems to point back to Matthew 10:39, whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. I'm not sure if you can believe it or not, but that was just verse 4. Yeah. Verse 5 and 6 go much, much, much faster because verse 4 has so much in it. Verse 5. So we continue to see that the rest of the dead who did not come to life until the close of the 1,000 years would be all of the faithful except the martyrs. We would also see the body of unbelievers. We don't need to look for anything like a literal fulfillment of the predictions shaped by the conditions of a transient period of history. With that said, only if the martyrs of the first resurrection are taken as symbolic of the church universal would the second resurrection be limited to the ungodly. The phrase, "this is the first resurrection," continues the thought from verse 4 and refers to the resurrection of the martyrs. So they could be part of the first resurrection and other people could be part of the second resurrection. That's some ways to look at it. Going into verse 6 here, those who are part of the first resurrection are pronounced blessed and holy. The idea of blessed and holy tells us three things. They are not subject to a second death, something that we'll see those who are evil and follow Satan would end up in. They will be priests of God and Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years. The second death is what we know from chapter 20, verse 14 and 18 is being cast into the lake of fiery sulfur, sulfury fire. This is the same fate of the devil, the beast, and the false prophet. While the first resurrection is selective, let's look at it more as the first group to enjoy resurrection. This is the first resurrection. Then again, there's no reference to bodily resurrection in this chapter, verses 4 through 6. The second group of resurrection seems to be universal. The first death is virtually universal, and the second death will be selective. Many in the first death will be alive in the return of Christ. So much to this. Wow. A lot to digest as we go through this. Let's look at the next section. Verses 7 through 10. When the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, those are fun names, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. That's a lot of people. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and beloved city. A fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Okay. Wow. We knew Satan was going to be released since verse 3, so this is not new. It's not a big surprise. One explanation for why this is happening is to show that the designs of Satan or the waywardness of humans will be altered by the mere passing of time. Satan picks up where he left off and has a bunch of his old friends to join him. As we look at verse 8, Satan leaves his bonds and, like the false prophets, continues to be a deceiver, bringing darkness to the world. Based on one reading of this, it seems that Satan is deceiving the nations to gather them for battle. The nations that come to do the bidding of Satan come from the four corners. That is to point out to the universality of evil. Evil is all over this world, even the United States. The nations are described as Gog and Magog. We know that from Genesis 10:2, Magog is listed as one of the sons of Japheth. You can go back and look at that because that's important. In Ezekiel 38:2, Gog is the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, who lead the invasion against Israel. These are not the names that some have said are modern ways of saying Moscow, as in Russia, or Tobolsk. They are Hebrew names of the East Anatolian groups, two classical historians as Moshi and Tabarini. So this is not Moscow that we're talking about here. So let's all get over that. Magog is the territory located to the far north from Ezekiel 39:2. That's a reference to that. Here in Revelation, the two countries represent the nations of the world that come together in their final assault against God. There's nothing geographical is intended here. They're just hostile nations to God and to God's people. Some have said that this assault of God and Magog could be modeled after the invasion of the Scythian army into Asia in 630 BC. Some go as far as to say that Gog and Magog are mythical characters, and this line of the apocalypse should be looked at as that as well. So you can have mythical history, historical mythology. Yeah, the myth of Gog would be what enshrines a deep insight into the resilience of evil. Not saying there is no historical truth to this, the war depicted here would be distinguished from what we saw in 1714 and 1919, in that it follows the thousand-year reign. Again, Revelation is something that you don't look at lightly, nor do you look at it from a surface level. You have to dig deep into it. I'm digging, but not deep. And you see, you can't just grab parts of Revelation and say, and that's what it is, premillennialism or postmillennialism or, Moscow and China and the Red Dragon and this sort of thing. You have to really dig deep into it and understand the context of what is being said here. Verse 9. The nations have been gathered by Satan surrounding the millennial capital and are devoured from fire from heaven. We see a parallel in 2 Esdras, another piece of a contemporary apocalyptic literature to what is happening here, where an innumerable multitude set up to battle against the man from the sea. All right, the breadth of the earth is not clear, but seems to be a metaphor for a great plain, large enough to accommodate a multitude of beings. We're not going to just say humans because it seems like there were other beings involved. The same phrasing was used in Exodus 14:19-20 when referring to the encampments of the people of Israel during their time wandering in the wilderness. The fire that comes down is reminiscent of 2 Kings 1 when Elijah calls down fire from heaven to consume groups of 50 soldiers and their captains. We also have similar judgment of Gog, Ezekiel 38:22, and Magog in Ezekiel 39:6. So though Gog and Magog are not talked about a lot, they do show up periodically, especially in the Old Testament. Verse 10, now things seems like we're just flying based on what we saw in verse 4, which took a long time. Okay, verse 10, notice here the devil does not face the same fate as those who follow. They are devoured by fire from heaven, but he is cast into the sulfur pit that is on fire, or the fiery pit. Recall from 1920, the beast and false prophets have already been tossed into the fiery lake, and so now they're joined by the biggest evil culprit of all. So we have the torment of the Holy Trinity, unceasingly torment day and night forever and ever. I'm sorry, it should be the torment of the unholy Trinity being tormented day and night. We have the final and everlasting destruction here of the forces of evil, which have plagued us since what we'd refer to as the Garden of Eden. Last few verses 20, chapter 20, 11 through 15. Continue on. Then I saw a great white throne and him who sat upon it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged from the things which were written in the book according to their deeds. There's the book of deeds. No one talks about the book of deeds. And the sea gave up the dead and which were in it, and the death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them, and they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. All right, as we continue on here, we look at verses 11 through 15, the final judgment. We have the vision continue where the evil finds its final expression. Satan is now released after a thousand-year bondage and wreaks havoc, and then is thrown into the lake of sulfury fire. And now that is done, the rest of the dead, from verse 5, are to be judged. So this is where you enter, bum, bum, bum. By the end of this judgment, we forever close the chapter of sin and evil and are ready to enter the eternal state of glory. Verse 11, we are the scene of the final judgment, where John sees a great white throne and one who sits upon it. This is similar to the Ancient of Days, coming down like the Son of Man. From Daniel 7, the color and size conveys its grandeur and its authority, the appearance reflecting the presence of the glory of God. There's debate regarding who is on the throne. Is it God or is it the Christ? We're going to go with God here. We typically read in the New Testament that it is the Son. In the New Testament, the Son. One example in Matthew 5:22, the Father judges no one, but entrusted all judgment to the Son. We're still going to go with God here because I'll give you a reason here in a second. First, Enoch says eschatological judgment is the function of the Messiah. However, that's what he learned from First Enoch. Again, an argument for the judgment being the Messiah. However, in the present passage, it seems that it is God who is on the throne and is the one to judge, maybe to rule, depending, again, on that translation of that. Other times in Revelation, we see that it is the Father on the throne from chapter 4:5-1, chapter 6:16 and 19:4, and many others along the way. This seems like more in context with the natural role of the Father here. From other parts of the New Testament, it seems like it may be a combination of the Father and Son providing judgment. We have the judgment seat of Christ in 2 Corinthians 5:10, and the judgment of seat of God in Romans 14:10. With this combination, it seems there's a unity between the two, leading to not a lot of reason to quibble over who exactly this is. Based on knowing what is in John 10:30, I and the Father are one. So quibble away if you'd like, but no quibble needed if you don't. I'm going to go with God here, and we know that the earth and the heaven flee upon the coming of God. We can, of course, look at this as poetic imagery, which most likely it is, showing or expressing the fear of those who are evil and corrupt in the presence of God and what they will do based on God being there at that time. Another way to look at this is the dissolution of the current universe and the making of the new heaven and the new earth that will shortly appear in our next chapter. Jesus pointed this when he mentioned in transition to the new heaven and the new earth back in Matthew 24:35. There seem to be a couple of variations of the passing of the heaven on the earth, but that is not the primary focus here. What we're trying to see is that God is in charge and has come to judge all who have fallen under the spell of evil. With the presence of God on the judgment throne, there is not a place to go. Continue on into verse 12. Both the great and the small stand before God. The rest of the dead are the ones who are resurrected at the close of the thousand-year period that we saw in verse 5. If we were to believe that the first resurrection was limited to the martyrs, here it seems the resurrection is both the believer and non-believer alike. However, if the second resurrection is of the evil people only, then the judgment is for those who will be sent to the lake of fire. We have to see there that there's a reference to the Book of Life in this section, which suggests a general judgment of the entire human race without the martyrs. The reference we see, though, is to the big and small tells us that nobody is too big to be judged, and that nobody is too unimportant to not to be judged. The judgment here seems to be based on a character, or your character, what was written about every person. The book is opened, and the dead are judged based on what they have done. We get a good example from Dante's Divine Comedy. He did a good job with that. Men are seen permanently fastened to the central meaning which they have given to their lives. I think that is a good quote to think about. What is our life all about? It is to be written in the Book of Life, as you'll see later on. Throughout the Old Testament and New Testament, there's judgment regarding the works of someone's life. Like in Psalm 62:12, the accepted principle that God requires a person according to his works, or requits a person towards works. Sorry. Jeremiah 17:10, God says, I, the Lord, search the heart and examine the mind to reward a man according to his conduct, according to what his deeds deserve. In the New Testament, Paul writes in Romans 2:6, God will give to each person according to what he has done. This is not a salvation by works argument, but that works is the evidence of a person's actual relationship with God. Some would refer to those as the fruit. Salvation, we know, is by faith, but faith is revealed by the works it provides. We're dealing with two books here, the Book of Life and the record of people's deeds. This is this idea of a divine book is ancient, such as goes back as Isaiah 4:3. Recall that Moses asked God actually to blot his name out of the book. The idea of a book back then was extremely important because there are very few of them, and most people did not know how to read. And so they knew the importance. That's why John brings this up into books. They knew the importance of books and how significant they were and how they could literally remove people from existence, especially if you look at the census. So this was a big understanding for them. For us, we have, you know, that tens of millions and hundreds of millions of even of books that we see. And so it's not as big of a deal, but to them, it would absolutely be a big deal. It's hard to determine the relationship between the two books. It is mostly agreed, however, that the judgment precedes the evidence supplied by both books, which supports a general judgment than one that is just restricted to those who are evil. Everyone, no matter how good you are, will be judged. And according to this, no matter how evil you are, will be judged. You know, everyone, at some level, at some point, will be judged. Verse 13, we now have a lot of elements giving up their dead, like the sea. This being here is not out of order based on the judgment in the previous verses, and even if it is, John has the liberty to do based on this type of literature. Apocalyptic guys can write in different chronological order. Doesn't matter. The reason he brings this up is to see the scope of judgment. Not even those who drowned in the sea and were not buried, so there are many people who are not buried, would get away from judgment. The reference to death in Hades points to chapter 6, verse 8, and the pale horse, and in chapter 1, verse 18. They represent the regions of the underworld whose keys are in the possession of Christ. As we knew, Hades and the sea were chaotic places, and so that was something that would also really resonate with the people, that even from the seas, that no one goes there. Why would you even touch that? That is nuts. Crazy land. Crazy time. We do not deal with the sea. The sea is scary. We stay away from it. So that's why this is important. Hades has been represented differently throughout the New Testament. In Acts 2:27, Hades points to a place also souls go during the intermediate state. And in places like Luke 16:23, it is a place where the unrighteous dead will go. I guess we'll find out when we get there. The dual concept of Hades existed in the Old Testament and makes its way into New Testament thought. So with that, it's difficult to really know who is being resurrected from Hades. We can surmise that does not include the martyrs that we'd already talked about earlier on. Last two verses 14 and 15, as we wrap up here. Death and Hades are now both tossed into the burning fire of doom, pit, the lake. We can believe that the idea of the lake of fire is not about annihilation, but instead of torturous existence. In society of evil and opposition to life, to the society of God. So opposition, good versus evil. That's what we've been going through this entire book, is darkness over light, goodness over evil, light wins. The false prophet and the devil are already in, and it seems from 1 Corinthians 15:26, that the death is the last enemy to be destroyed. And said in Isaiah 25:8, death will be swallowed up forever, so last death is tossed into the lake of fire. Remember, the lake of fire indicates not only stern punishment awaiting the enemies of righteousness, but also their full and final defeat. It is a second death that is given to those whose temporary resurrection results only in the return to death and its punishment. As Alfred again writes, we like Alfred, as there is a second and higher life, so there's also a second and deeper death. And then after that life, there's no more death. So after that death, there's no more life. So alas, the final judgment will be on those whose name does not appear in the book of life. This is a simplistic narrative compared to what we see in, say, 1 Enoch 48:9, where the wicked are given over into the hands of the elect, in whose presence they burn like straw in the fire and sink like lead in the water. I thought that was pretty good. Thank you, Enoch. Anyways, we're done. That's it. On to chapter 21. Oh my gosh, look how many verses that is. That is a nut show, 27 verses. That is going to be so much fun. I'm looking forward to it. Anyways, have a good rest of your day as we get ready for chapter 21 next time. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.